This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, root cellar Sue Balcom joins us to talk about buttoning up the yard and garden as we get into the cold weather season. But joining me now is baritone Chris Kenny. He is originally from Hawley, Minnesota. He is a graduate of Concordia College in Moorhead, and he is on the line with me from the Grand Atrium at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City, where he is performing as Chester in Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And there will be a movie screening of the live performance coming up this Saturday that you can watch in theater across the country. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Ashley. It's a pleasure.
Congratulations on making it to the Met.
You know, it's been an awesome trip, and I have so many people to thank, and I'm so grateful to be here.
I recently heard an interview where a guy who loves comic books was talking about how when you read a comic book, it is a story of fear and redemption and love and emotion. And I think it's easy for people to sort of roll their eyes at comic books as having any depth. And for someone like me, it's hard for me to get into opera in the same way. And I'm wondering, for someone who knows what they're talking about, what is it that draws you to the art of storytelling through operatic singing?
The biggest thing where operatic performance is concerned for me has always been the grand spectacle. Mm-hmm. Some of the first operas I ever went to were La Boheme, Traviata, Don Giovanni, big sets, dramatic music, and just this absolute spectacle where you saw, I mean, the first time I came and saw this at the Met, went and saw La Boheme, there were full horses, 150 plus people on stage. The orchestra's playing. It's just such a draw-in that is a unique experience that you really don't get in things like live theater or maybe just comparable to musical theater, but with such a raw energy and emotion. And oftentimes, I'm a lover of language. So most of our operas are done in Italian, mm-hmm. French, German. So it gives you this epic sense of the world around you and the cultural reach of such an ancient art form. And a lot of that drew me in. And I was naturally lucky, gifted to be good at singing these. And I had great mentors who drew me in and showed me the highest of baritone arias to the softest of art song. And the whole process really drew me in. And it's so unique in its breadth of knowledge. And just overall, it makes you feel so many things where you can just sit and be a part of a community taking in a scene.
Well, that was beautiful. Thank you. Let's give our listeners a sense of what you can really do. We're going to hear, why don't you set us up? You sent us a clip of Five Songs of Lawrence Hope. What is this?
Yes. So this is a piece. These were poems written by a woman under the pseudonym of Lawrence Hope, based off of Kashmiri songs in British Empire, India, where she had to write these under a pseudonym just to get them published. And then she eventually committed suicide after she was married to a man 30, several years her senior. And the poems were then found by H.T. Burley, who set them to music. And H.T. Burley, a very prolific African-American composer in America, and he put these songs to music. And I was introduced to them through a coach and a colleague of mine. And I fell in love with them immediately. They talk about interracial love and having something that is socially not really acceptable back then. And the story is timeless. It can be anything you put your mind to it. And that's part of the reason I love songs like this. You can just apply yourself into either a character or a multitude of characters. So this particular one that you'll hear is we have had, we have loved, we have known, and it just absolutely, it's heart-wrenching and beautiful, and it's probably my favorite in the whole set of five.
Is the voice of Chris Kenny. He is performing at the Metropolitan Opera House in the role of Chester in Fire Shut Up in My Bones. Chris, in just 90 seconds, you took us to so many places. And I'm wondering how that feels in your body and in the mind as you are singing these strong, and I'm sorry that I don't know all the right musical words to use, but as you come from a place of deep strength and presence, and then there is such a softness at the end of that, and to be able to go back and forth between those two sort of moods and those two different places that you sing from in the body.
Yes. At first, when I started off, I'm a big dude with a lot of bravado. I'm very high energy. I love being big, forward, in your face, kind of stuff like that. But when I really came into the artistry, I had to learn vulnerability. Because an audience can smell when you're lying to them. You know, everybody's experienced this. You know, when someone, you're watching something, listening to someone speak, play, sing, and they're phoning it in. But you can't do that. You have to give yourself wholly to that of which you are communicating, because pieces like what you just heard and what I do here and what I do in so many things, be they high energy or very, very intimate, you have to give yourself wholly to it. Otherwise, the message is disrespected and lost. Things that you find connection with are key. Even if it's a hard piece, like the one I'm doing here at the Met, I have a very difficult role to do, but you have to find connection on some level so that you can give back to an audience member who is listening or even participating. And you yourself are an active participant in that art form. I mean, when I do, one of my favorite things is I love playing small, intimate venues where you can really see people's faces. Oftentimes, singing on a big stage like the Met isn't the scariest thing for me because you're so far away from people. They're just kind of shadows in the background.
Yeah.
But when you're up close and personal in a room of 50 to 90 people and you can hear them breathing, feel their heat, smell the crowd, it's so much more of a connection. And having music like this, where it is very, very deeply emotionally rooted in the soul of wherever it is you have to go, by doing that, He gives such a performance and such a connection that is absolutely insurmountable, in my opinion.
You said you have to be able to find this connection with the character so that you can come off from a place of authenticity. Chester in Fire Shut Up in My Bones, and this is a memoir from Charles Blow, it's the story of, well, a lot of things, but the role of Chester is one of a molester. He brought incredible pain and shame to Charles. How do you find connection with a character that causes so much pain?
I'm not going to lie to you. When I first got this role, I was pretty disgusted. I was contacted and I said, hey, you're going to be singing at the Met. And I was out of my socks excited. I was like through the moon. And then they said to me, hey, here's your role assignment. And I looked it up and my heart sank. And I said, how? I mean, something so socially abhorrent and just absolutely disgusting. How am I going to find truth and connection with such a role that is, it's been a process. I mean, first, credit mates here at the Met, they are some of the most professional people I've ever worked with, period. And the care that was taken with this role, I cannot understate. They have been working with us for day one, checking in, saying, hey, listen, this is the story, this is the work, but we got to do it, but we also got to make sure that y'all are okay too. And I don't want to say that I have the hardest role on the show, because I really don't. There's just too many factors that you couldn't possibly take into account, whereas the role of Charles, my colleague Will Liverman, who just puts on a gangbusters performance, to Billy, played by LaTonya Moore, who plays this mother character who is just heartbroken, and it's so many facets to the show that just speak so deeply and powerfully. And then there's Chester, who I have to play, and it's this two-faced character. He has a very public face that it's kind of scary, because you know, you say, oh, that's a very sociable person. That's someone you want to be in. And it's almost like psychology, like clinical psychology 101. It's like you're seeing someone who puts up a facade.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have this deep, horrible, dark secret. And at one point he turns at the end of the scene. And it's just, you see this disgusting monster. And it's just such a facade that is so real. And having to connect with that is hard. I have to go to a place that is very secure in my own being. I know who I am. And a lot of my friends came forward who had done similar roles, very violent criminal roles, stuff like that, both in musical theater, opera, and straight theatric and movie performance. And I asked them, and I said, how do you connect with a character without losing yourself in it? And there's a almost like a dissonance in your own self when you play characters like this. If you give yourself too much, there's obviously this dissonance. You are not this person, but you have to be them, think like them, act like them. And they just, my friends were very, very helpful in this whole process. And they said, you know what? You have to go to a place where you are intelligently guarded, where you can still give the performance, connect with the character, and portray this person. But then as soon as it's done, you need to be able to step out. It's almost like a fighter in the ring. It's, you are in the ring for that moment. You know what you have to do. You fight it out. But as soon as you're out, you're out. You leave it in the ring. That's what I look at it like. You leave it all in the ring.
And you're doing this in what is being called a watershed moment before the Met. It took a solid 138 years of the Met's existence to put on a performance with a black composer and with an all-black cast.
Yes.
The pressure of all of these things at the same time, Chris.
You know what? We don't shy away from a challenge here at Trading Rob. No, but another thing that another very unique thing that is kind of understated, it's a black living composer, Terrence Blanchard, who was in the room with us. So what a lot of people don't realize is that canonically opera is written by dead old dudes is what we say. And so you can't ask Wagner, hey, how did you want this line to be sung? But it's such a unique opportunity to have Terrence Blanchard in the room. And I mean, he's a jazz cat. He's awesome. Trumpet player, jazz musician, professor. And having him sitting there and saying, hey, Terrence, I want to take this line a different way. He's like, all right, cool. How about this? And he rewrites it for you. I mean, the show is not the same show we started with when we began rehearsals in August. I mean, I'm singing different lines. I got to put my thumbprints and my fingerprints all over this score that when it's done in maybe 100 years time, the program notes will be my notes. It'll be my contributions. It'll be my friends' contributions. It'll be everything that could possibly come from such a watershed moment like this, like you said, and being able to participate in that is just, it's mind-boggling to me. And I don't think we've even started to realize the ramifications that this show has. I mean, on opening night, I look out and I see a packed house at the Met, which in a time where it was 18 months almost of no shows at the Metropolitan Opera, we now have this opportunity to perform art again. And it's art that we can all connect with. And it's just such a great opportunity.
Chris Kenny will be performing as Chester in Fire Shut Up in My Bones. You can watch a movie version of this. There will be a movie screening of the operatic production this Saturday, October 23rd. Chris, did you grow up singing?
Actually, yes, I did. I was heavily involved in music from a younger age. I sang in choirs when I was younger. I was very, as we all know, in Minnesota, North Dakota, the choral scene is next to none. I mean, it is just such a luxury that I had growing up.
Concordia has an amazing program.
Doc Clawson, now I was in Doc Clawson's choir for 3 years. I got to be a soloist all three of those, and I was so blessed to be able to sing with such gifted musicians every single week. I mean, I look back at that, and a lot of that was the launch pad to a very fruitful career that I've had. And even before that, high school, I had mentors in my choir and band. I played saxophone. I played jazz piano poorly. Let me say that. I know Doc Ferrera's out there and he's like the lion. But I loved all sorts of music, and I had these great mentors who showed me that, oh, you can travel the world and do all this. You can broaden your horizons to go places, and you can be good at it. Not even good, you can be great at it. And it's without their support, I wouldn't be here if I didn't have them. I did not do this alone. I could not do this alone. I mean, I don't think that I can overstate that fact enough, that these people, these communities gave me the chance, my folks driving me to practices and beating me up about, hey, you learn that music yet? You do that? You do this? And it was very interesting for me because it originally wasn't what I thought I was destined for. I'm a private pilot. Actually, I'm a commercial pilot, CFI. I teach flight instruction now in my off time, and I thought I was going to be a fighter pilot.
Wow.
That's all I ever wanted. Yeah. I originally wanted to join Northwest Airlines as a captain on the 74, and 08 happened a little bit before I graduated high school, and I was actually disqualified from being able to join the Air Force because I was allergic to nuts as a kid, even though I outgrew it for the most part. So I wasn't able to be a fighter pilot, and I just kind of said, oh, what now? And my music saved me. And I had all these people who said, you're not going to be lost in this world. You will be fine. And I've found a way to make both loves and passions of mine work, where I have a flying career and a singing career that are both very fruitful and very fulfilling to me. I mean, it's like having left arm and right arm for me. And I'm just so blessed by the mentors and friends that I continue to have and make everywhere. And that music, it keeps driving me forward.
How do you stay in singing shape? Your voice is your instrument. You have to care for that.
Lots of coffee. Black, no cream, no sugar.
Okay.
No, I understand what you're saying. I am an infrequent visitor of the gym. I'm a big fan of being able to shut it off, kind of like what I was saying earlier. You have to have things that feed your soul and your wallet and your time. So I think a lot of people talk about burnout when it comes to the arts. They're burned out. They're going from show to show to show. I mean, what a lot of people don't realize about let's just talk about an operatic career, is you are in a different place. If you have a full-time career, if you want to go throttle to the ball, you are going to be 2.5 months in New York. You'll be immediately after that in Cleveland doing something. And then after that, you're going to be in Munich doing something for another 2 months or 2 weeks. And then you got a symphony gig. And then maybe you got a week off for Christmas and you go see some family. But that's also time that you might get called up for something. And the whole time you're learning roles for the next month, year, and they'll assign you something. Hey, the Met called and they want you for 2024. And so now you're planning out 2024 and you're having to say, hey, I'm not going to be able to make that wedding. Hey, I'm not going to be able to make your birthday. I'm sorry. And it's a lot of people get stressed out and they do burn out because they don't take care of their heart and their head in addition to their voice. So a lot of it for me, I look at it very practically. I just say, you know what? It's like work. You shut it off when you go home. You watch some football. You have a drink. You cook some steak, and you just have a good time. But you have to put it down, and you have to find something. I'm a big proponent of find something outside. Find, like, have a fulfilling life. It's like, that's why I do flying. That's why I'm a pilot, and I will never give it up because I got my music, but I also have that. It's not one-dimensional identity. You have to be multidimensional. And I think that's what really saves me, to be honest.
Baritone Chris Kenny. He is originally from Holly, Minnesota, a Concordia College graduate performing at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York in their production of Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And you can watch this in a movie theater near you this Saturday. Chris, thank you so much for your time and congratulations again.
Ashley, thank you so much for having me. It was great to be back in Prairie Public.
My days are empty, my nights are long. Oh, why is a thing so sweet so wrong? Why is a thing so sweet so
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Still to come on Prairie Public, Dakota Folklife. But first, this news.
Good afternoon. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. A legislative interim committee is studying the state's developmental disability services and autism spectrum disorder programs. The committee, is hiring a consultant to look at what services are provided and where any gaps are. State Human Services Director Chris Jones.
Our number one goal is to make sure that people can live within the community, can participate in the community, can lead successful lives as they define their success. So making sure that we provide them the right level of support based on what they want to be within each of their communities.
Jones says the study will also take a look at workforce issues.
Because as we all know, the workforce is becoming more difficult to come by, but we have an obligation to serve those individuals with developmental disabilities and intellectual disabilities to be the best they can be.
The study is under the purview of the Interim Human Services Committee. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says he's gaining confidence that Mexico's looming ban on genetically modified corn won't mean U.S. corn growers will lose their biggest export market. When Vilsack toured farms and research facilities with the Mexican Ag Secretary Wednesday, he told reporters he thinks genetically engineered, or GE, exports will remain strong.
I was certainly pleased to hear from the Secretary an understanding that while there may be decisions made in Mexico not to cultivate GE corn, it doesn't limit the ability of Mexico to import GE corn.
More than 90% of the U.S. corn market is genetically modified. Mexico is phasing out those crops for human consumption by 2024. And five more North Dakotans have passed away with COVID-19. That brings North Dakota's death toll to 1,703. According to the State Health Department's coronavirus dashboard, 543 individuals from 45 counties have also tested positive. Today's results are from a batch of 9,887 tests for a daily positive rate of 5.89%. There are currently 3,565 active confirmed cases statewide. Of those new cases, 123 were found in Cass County, 62 in Burley County, and 46 in Ward County. 189 people are currently hospitalized due to COVID-19, and since yesterday, 481 people have recovered. And the executive director of the North Dakota Aeronautics Commission says when compared year to year, passenger boardings in the state's eight largest commercial airports nearly doubled during the month of September. Kyle Warner says nearly 75,000 people departed from airports across the state last month, marking an 89% increase in air travel. Warner says despite the encouraging level of travel, the COVID-19 pandemic still has a solid grip on the airline industry, as does a workforce shortage in the industry. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
The Cinema 100 Fall Series for 2021 continues on Thursday, October 14th, with the documentary film about novelist Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. The films to follow are Limbo, First Cow, and the classic The Graduate from 1967. Each film is shown twice on Thursdays at 3 and 5:30 p.m. at the Grand 22 Theater in Bismarck. More information can be found at the Cinema 100 Facebook page.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Telltale, Dakota Folklife and Stories, is a collection of narratives describing the shared personal experiences and lore of life on the North Dakota Plains. They feature interviews with senior citizens, many of whom are in elder care facilities. The most recent episodes feature veterans. Here's David Swenson, who owns Makoche Studios in Bismarck, where Telltale is produced.
David Daly is a veteran who served in Vietnam. He spent most of his life as a teacher in North Dakota and is currently a resident of the Good Samaritan Society Care Facility in Lakota, North Dakota. As with all the veterans we spoke with, we asked David to write a poem about himself titled Where I'm From as a way to get to know him and hopefully spark some of his own memories.
I'm from a two-story house with four bedrooms and shared a room with my brother. The smell of Mom's cooking was always present. I am from the purple flowers from the front of our porch. I'm a family man, gathering at Christmas and getting together for all occasions. From Brother John and Dad Warren, Bud, and Mom Florence. I'm from naps after dinner and Mom's deep cleaning. Very close-knit family. I knew I was in trouble when Mom called me David Warren and don't do as I do, but do as I say. Any Johnny Cash song is for me. I'm from driving a car, certain things you can do in less. No scratches. I'm from Kenmore, North Dakota, Norwegian and Irish. Lefse and Mom's homemade bread and Dad's chili. From the backing of mice into my sister's boyfriend's car and hiding from Dad for 6 weeks. I'm from the Marine Corps, an E-4 corporal, an MCRD in San Diego, and then to Vietnam. Grandpa's pipe and Indian head couldn't be touched. Mama put flour in it and blow just to make it look like smoke was coming out of it. We kept in the china cabinet, still have the china cabinet today, January 13th, 2020. This was good to have this sheet of paper in front of us. In many cases, I'm a man of few words. I don't like talking about myself. I was born in Kenmore, North Dakota. It's a small community northwest of Minot, about 50 miles. I grew up on a farm and we had milk cows. My sister and I used to milk the cows. My father drove the bus. And he would be coming down the road and we knew that we had so much time to finish. We had to hurry to get done those cows. They knew exactly where to stand and how to stand. Those cows, shall we say, were a lot like people. I spent 2 days in the hospital over there. My brother accidentally shot me in the foot with my shotgun. And it ruined my boot. And the boots were just brand new. I just bought them. But my dad, when he got out of the car, he threw this boot at a great distance. It hit the ground. It was just a thud. And I spent 2 days in the hospital, or 2 or 3 days in the hospital. And I remember this nurse coming in. She picked my toes up. And I started in on her. And I was using profanity. And my mother walked in the door and she said, "David Warren, the pastor's outside. You don't talk like that." And I said, "She touched my foot. I don't care." It was painful. When I got out of high school, I went to the Marine Corps and then to Vietnam, 18 at the time. And I don't talk about Vietnam, if possible. After I got out of the service, I went back home, and then I married a young lady that got me into school in Dickinson. And I went back to school, and there I spent just about 3 years learning to teach. And I always thought, you know, why am I teaching? And then it dawned on me, these young kids, every once in a while you would see a spark in their eye, and then you would press on. I loved it. I liked being a teacher because of the students. I loved it when you looked out over the students and you see someone's bright eyes that gave you a sense of accomplishment. I was happy to be teaching. That was accepted, but there was something that was missing. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. I found out 5 years ago that I had PTSD, and I didn't know what that was. But they said it was service-connected. And I said, "Well, thanks a bunch." You know, I didn't know what I had, but I had trouble talking to people. And it was that way, and it's just that, I don't know, it was hard to imagine what it had been like, you know, if we'd have been thanked for doing our job that we were sent to do. Many of us were young people at the time, 18 years old, and we went to Vietnam and we did our job and we came home, and many of us, shall we say, did not get a thank you for going as the World War II veterans. I remember that they felt pride in the fact that they had won a war and we didn't win in Vietnam. We did our job and we did it well, but then we were left without having been told thank you.
Produced in partnership with the Good Samaritan Society Care Facility in Lakota, North Dakota, and Dakota Legacy. This project is produced in part with a grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts, which receives funding from the North Dakota State Legislature and the National Endowment for the Arts.
Telltale Dakota Folklife and Stories is available as a Prairie Public podcast, with new episodes added as they become available. Sue Balcom is next.
Hi, I'm Tom Brousseau. Hear a live session from a true folk troubadour next time on The Great American Folk Show. Dan Byrne is a prolific singer-songwriter, painter, and teacher who once gained rock and roll notoriety by smashing an acoustic guitar on the stage. And if that wasn't who enough, Roger Daltrey recently chose him to open a tour.
When I tell you that I love you, don't test my love, accept my love. Don't test my love, 'cause maybe I don't love you all that much.
Writer and poet Daniel Pollack will be on the show. Renowned letterpress printer Ben Blount and singer-songwriter Brett Benjamin.
I'm so in love, I want this to be easy.
Plus, learn about Fargo's upcoming Chris Kindle Market on The Great American Folk Show, Sunday, November 7th at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Joining me now from our Bismarck studio is root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week for Main Street Eats from her farm outside of Mandan, the root cellar's farm, to talk about food. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So I don't know how it goes in your house, but in my marriage, it's supposed to be whoever does the cooking, the opposite person does the cleaning. But I'm one of those people who's just constantly cleaning. So there's never actually that much cleaning that my husband has to do when I
know it's not fair,
yeah,
is it?
No, and then he is like, no, I'm going to leave all the things for you to clean up. Cleaning up such an important part of that food equation. And true, also when it's in the garden, when you're growing your own food.
Absolutely. There are things that you can do in the fall that will make your life so much easier in the springtime. Starting with the best part, of course, is harvesting your vegetables, you know.
Yeah, eating them.
Yeah, harvesting, eating them, and saving seed and doing all that kind of stuff. But, you know, in the fall, you can leave your cold weather crops out in the garden until after the first or second or third light frost. Now, if there's a freeze, you want to hurry up and get that stuff out of the garden because, like I've said before, my husband does not like to dig carrots out of frozen ground. He said he would never do that again. So I'm always watching the weather. Now, we did have like a little bit of a light frost. So we had kind of like a reveal party for our pumpkins and squash. I'm like, whoa, check it out. Look at all those pumpkins we didn't know were hiding adorable. Underneath those leaves. It's great, but we don't know whether they're male or female. I don't know if it matters. But anyway, the gender doesn't matter on a pumpkin because, of course, Halloween will be coming up here soon, and then we'll be carving those babies up or decorating them somehow to just kind of like celebrate the harvest. So first thing you want to do in the fall is make sure you get everything out of your garden. Like, use it up. I mean, we just made green tomato salsa because we got a lot of little green tomatoes, and I'm like, oh, we should throw these away. And then JC's like, but I really like this. And I'm like, okay, if you help me, we can do it together. And so that worked out in my favor. We both cut well, but then he sat down when I started on the jalapenos because he said, they'll make me cough. And I'm like, oh, I guess that means I'm cleaning it up. So it works. And as you go along and harvest, you know, one of the things that you can do almost all summer long, but really you should do a thorough job of pulling all of your plants out of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Do not put them in your compost pile, especially if there's any kind of indication that they might be diseased, because that will spread then, you know, like your whole soil system might get contaminated from that. So
if they're not diseased, is it okay to put in the compost?
Yeah, we just don't. You know, they sometimes have insect eggs underneath them, and, you know, they just, we just kind of keep it away from, we compost those kind of separately and let them do their own thing. And you do know that if you wait till after that first frost for tomatoes and cucumbers, things that are bigger than you, it's a lot easier to pull them out of your garden. And then, of course, we rake up all the fruit that might have fallen off and the leaves and stuff and kind of get as much of that picked up as possible. And I can hear, and this just makes me want to shudder. I can hear the weed seeds as we're pulling some, you know, rogue weeds that were hiding underneath our plants out. You can actually just hear them falling off into the garden. And I'm like,
planting themselves.
Yes, stop, stop, stop.
I'm going to take over the garden.
Oh, man. I swear, next year I am going to weed my little heart out in all of my gardens. I kind of had a favorite garden this year that I weeded, like, exponentially more than the other two, and it shows, you know, but that's my favorite.
Are the other
spot.
Two gardens getting mad at that garden?
Siblings? Pretty soon they'll be like throwing weed seeds across the yard at each other. Like, you take that. That would be pretty funny, wouldn't it?
Yes. I think that's probably what happens when you're sleeping, Sue. You should stay up all night
totally,
and watch your gardens.
Totally, totally. And make sure that they're being nice to each other. it's a good time in the fall to actually feed your garden too, because, you know, it's been producing, like, I'm not kidding you, man, I got 14 foot tall sunflowers, and my zinnias are 2 feet taller than I am, which would put them at about 7 feet tall. I don't know why they're growing tall like that, but they're just having a heyday.
Crazy tall.
It's awesome. I have to bend them over to look at them before I can cut them to make sure that they're still viable, you know?
Wow.
So think about that. These plants have been sucking the good stuff out of your soil all summer long. So you want to, you know, add some compost. We usually stir up our soil. We don't use a tiny tiller anymore because that causes hard pan eventually underneath your topsoil. And so we have what is called a harrow, which has like fingers, and it stirs up the top 3 or 4 inches of the soil and then leaves the little microbes and all that little connection of good stuff intact underneath it. But it's a good time to add, you know, leaf mold, some good composted manure. Actually, if you're going to follow food safety rules now, this in the fall, 120 days before you harvest any edible vegetables from your garden is when you need to put your manure on your garden, just to be on the safe side. And then, of course, if you've never had your soil tested, you could do a soil test, and then you could decide, you know, we have beautiful sandy soil. Like, our potatoes this year are so amazing because the sandy soil is loose and allows root vegetables to spread out as far as they want. So we don't usually, we add, you know, compost to our garden, some lime sometimes. What's the other stuff called that we use? Gypsum and things like that. You know, we'll sprinkle on the top and then we'll just, you know, a little here and there, because we know that our soil is sandy. But if you don't know what the content of your soil is, sometimes having that tested for pH, you know, you can add acid or
And that's a little kit you can go get, right?
Actually, you can get those from your local extension office, and I think they get mailed to NDSU, and the cost is like $20, and it's well worth it to find out if you should be adding a little ash to your garden, maybe some lime to raise the pH, you know, so... Or things that would help, like, loosen your clay.
Oh,
you know, like
that's
if
what
you
we
have
need.
Gumbo,
yeah,
then you need to gonna get some sand in there, some more compost, like leaf compost and things like that to help aerate that soil out and give the worms a chance to get down there and reproduce because we really like worms. And, oh, man, I'll tell you what. If you want to know if your soil's really good, dig about a square foot, make a square foot perimeter, and then get in there and dig it up and see how many earthworms you have. Because the more earthworms in a square foot of that soil, the more healthy your soil really is. So, and then you can go fishing if you so choose after you're done testing your soil. So,
there you go.
And don't put, you know, like you can, if you don't spray your lawn and it doesn't have a lot of weeds in, we didn't water our lawn this year with the drought, and there's a lot of things that I've never seen in our yard before coming up. So you don't want to ever cut that stuff off when it's seeding and put it on your garden because then you're just introducing more weed seeds to your garden. So timing is really critical when you're saving grass clippings for your garden, which we do, but
you
we
want
didn't
it so then towards the end of the growing season, very much those ones, right?
Well, you want to clip those before they seed out, before anything seeds out in your lawn. So, and then of course, you know, we have a lot of cottonwood trees in North Dakota, and you do not want to rake cottonwood leaves and put them on your garden because what they do is they're so plastic like.
Huh.
That they create a barrier so no moisture or air can get into your soil. So if you're going to use leaves, it's always really good to run your lawnmower over and chop them up. And I'll tell you, if you don't want weeds to grow, though, cottonwood leaf blankets are really the perfect thing for that. So,
all right.
And lastly, we got one more thing here. Take care of your tools. You know, get your tools cleaned, get a bucket of nice sand and pour some clean motor oil in there, mix it up, and then shove your little spades and things in there, your hand tools in there. That will keep them from rusting over the winter. You know, it keeps them away from the moisture. But, yeah, wash all that dirt off, oil your metal parts. If you have wooden handles on old tools, you can oil those too. And then store them not in your high tunnel or not in your greenhouse because that magnifies the sun and really, really eats that stuff up over the winter. Because, as you know, the sun is closer to us in the winter, I think, than in the summer. So take good care of your tools. Save your seeds, get your chemicals put away or your fertilizers put away someplace where they're not going to freeze. Tidy up your yard, make yourself a pot of soup and a loaf of bread and sit back and wait for winter.
We check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Ashley.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away With Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor and an IT guy, but I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we've kind of covered the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're not cobwebby old school marks. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away With Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 21st. On this date in 1915, Wahpeton residents were buzzing about the football game between rivals Wahpeton and Breckenridge. Cold temperatures and rain failed to dampen the enthusiasm of the large crowd attending the game. The main topic of conversation was what Wahpeton fans considered the poor sportsmanship of the Breckenridge team. Controversy centered on two players, which the local newspaper claimed were not qualified to play. The paper said both were over the age of 21 and were not high school students. A Breckenridge official denied the report. The newspaper maintained that it was poor sportsmanship to allow the two players on the field. The entire Breckenridge team was also accused of poor sportsmanship. One Wahpeton player was kicked in the head when he was down. The star Wahpeton quarterback was taken off the field after an unfair hit. In spite of the odds against them, the scrappy Wahpeton players acquitted themselves well. The first half ended with no score. The paper reported that the Wahpeton team came back to the field grim and determined, and angry through to the backbone on account of the dirty trick and unsportsmanship played on them. Breckenridge scored a touchdown early in the second half, but failed to make the extra point. The paper said Wahpeton came back with might and fury that fairly shook the ground. The team scored a touchdown and the extra point, making the score 7-6. Breckenridge drove the field in the final minutes. With only 30 seconds remaining, Breckenridge was on Wahpeton's 15-yard line. The Wahpeton fans prepared to go home, saddened by a looming loss as Breckenridge brought one of the accused ringers in to dropkick a game-winning field goal. Victory was at hand, and celebration was already beginning on the Breckenridge side of the field. But the game isn't over until it's over. It was a mighty kick, and a hush came over the crowd, but the ball sailed wide. Wahpeton fans erupted in cheers, and the town maintained bragging rights for another year. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, language shapes our cultural and personal identities. So what happens when a language is threatened by extinction? We are going to visit with Anton Troyer. He is a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State, and he joins us to talk about five books coming out in the Ojibwe language. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.